So to get us started, I'm going to just sort of ask a more sort of general question for everyone. And a lot in systems, we found that the user is the weak point, right? A lot of these attacks are attacking the user, and we're trying to find ways of making decisions by getting more context or asking the user decisions in different ways. And we're making claims that what we're doing is more usable. And we're system security people, we're not necessarily user study people, and user studies aren't necessarily the right way to go. We're showing proof of concept and prototype systems, and then the user studies would be really focused on, okay, what happened when you used UAC, a production system with that. So as you're taking your research forward and you're trying to have more rigorous evaluations than you would have for this venue where we're just sort of looking at ideas, what approaches should we be taking?
So I think you can do user studies on some of these topics without having a production system. I think you would just have to design. So, you know, not every study has to be, you know, a large sample and rigorous. You could perhaps just do a focus group on a prototype and try to find obvious problems and then start by targeting those obvious problems that you come across with, you know, five people. And also, you know, you could try to design studies that sort of control for known problems in the prototypes, like, okay, you know that it maybe looks a little crappy, you want to focus on this one particular aspect of how you're asking, et cetera. You could try to design your study so that you keep some things constant and vary others, so that you can see whether changing the one thing you care about is making an effect, as opposed to the fact that your prototype is fairly clunky.
So the other thing I was going just to add to what she said is there is a case for defining qualities of a system that are more like not qualitative, in the sense that for the context-centric, like, you can definitely just say that letting the users work with a high-level context is more intuitive, in that that is something that the users, for this is just for privacy, not for all kinds of security problems, right? But for many contexts, the users know, the users are already working with some real, they have a real world end in mind, right? So does our system help them achieve those ends or not? I think we can find out many different representative workflows and then run them with different users who want to execute those workflows and see that whether the end result matched their expectations or not. Because defining a system-wide definition of privacy is, it doesn't really make sense. It's not like preventing buffer overflows, which is a systematic thing that you can prevent, right? Privacy is different for every user. And to evaluate this, I think you will have to kind of work through real-world workflows and then see if they match.
But how do you get those real-world workflows? And so how do you know that this matches, that you don't have a lot of, so for example, in the case of your system, right, we have a lot of bubbles. Mm-hmm. And so we could, you know, you just have this room filled with bubbles, and then we have all this data tied to different bubbles, mm-hmm. and then I want to go and cherry pick some data from that bubble, and we make exceptions to that, and we're just going to get overloaded with all of this. And so while conceptually it's a straightforward approach, but then we run into...
That's a really good point. So this is something that we can actually quantify. So if we define, say, four or five different use cases, say there's a student who wants to do, like, this is his daily flow of events, for example. This is a company manager, this is his daily flow of events and things like that. So once you have a set of workflows, if you run them over time and you see that it is generating a lot of exceptions, that is something that you can definitely quantify. That, okay, this was the expectations, and to get there on the path, we encountered three or four exceptions.
So like a field study?
Sorry?
So you're talking about doing a field study? That's the type
yes.
of... Okay.
Yes.
And just before... Yeah, just if anyone has, so we're a community here, I'll let them go as well, but if anyone has ideas to contribute to this, because we have a lot of experts on these topics in the room, I don't want to leave the discussion just to the speakers. Go ahead.
I totally agree, and I just want to add that, especially for our mechanism of mitigating insider threats, we had some user experiment, but you know, due to the time limitation, we were only able to do that with the student population. And I think the user experiment is definitely needed for especially for prove the concept of the mitigation of insider threats, because our experiment actually showed that with the appropriate incentives provided to the students, as in our experiment, the participants, their behavior actually changed dynamically. Dramatically after a certain kind of incentives are provided. So, as I said in the presentation, I think more user study is needed, especially as a further step in our study is to how to quantify the risk. How do we determine the price of a risk? So after this kind of modeling, we definitely need some kind of user study to prove the efficacy of our mechanism. So I think it's absolutely needed in our design. Any
questions? Right. Roy Maxey and Carnegie Mellon. I guess I have a few questions addressed to whoever it is that wants to answer them, triggered partly by what people have already said so far. So one comment that was made is user studies need not be large and rigorous. And so I guess if they don't have enough sample size and they're not rigorous, where does credibility come from?
So there are different types of user studies, right, for very different types of purposes.
I'm very well aware, right, that there are different types of user studies, right? And I'm not asking the question directly of you or anybody else, but rather just to sort of throw it out for consideration. Any study needs to be credible at the end of the day, okay? And if you're not going to do it rigorously, then I just sort of wonder, and maybe other people would wonder too, where does the credibility come from? Moving on here to the next question. This is prompted by the talk about the bubbles. And I looked at that and I thought, well, you know, okay, I guess that could work. And the more bubbles that started appearing on the screen, right, the more I thought about the unbelievable cognitive load that's going to be put on users. And in fact, you know, in this whole sort of permissions thing, which my own lab has done some work on, it seems to me that cognitive load is the key element, right? But I don't ever really see any work on cognitive load. So I just wonder what anybody has to say about that. And then finally, I'm remembering back in the days of Xerox PARC in the early 80s, some of the things they had problems with were user interfaces, in particular on their copiers. So, you know, instead of getting some geek to figure out what was the problem, they went and got an anthropologist, Lucy Suchman was her name, right? And she's decided to ask a few users, well, so what is it that would work for you? And then they designed the interface around what the user's perceptions were. But I don't see that in these kinds of discussions. So I leave these questions to the panel and to anybody else who wants to offer some insight.
I'm sure I can take them on the board. Yeah, so great question about the bubbles. The thing that, and we actually noticed this while we were working using like a simulated bubbles without building the low-level system, but just the top-level UI part, that what tends to happen is that for any given, like this has been my experience, this might not port to a larger scale user study that we need to do, but what tends to happen is that I tend to have a very skewed distribution of bubbles. There are some bubbles that I keep coming back to every day, and then there are a lot of bubbles that are just one-off interactions that are there, and unless I need them sometime down the line, I don't need to go back into them a lot. So for me, I have two or three projects going on that I come and visit every day, and then there are a few long tail of bubbles that they just happen and they are there. The good thing about having small-scale bubbles is that it gives me a lot of flexibility with future resharing decisions. So if I meet somebody, if we have a chat outside, you know, and we create some information together, later you want to bring in some new person to work on this project that we start. That is definitely possible, and you will know that some other conversation you had with a second person is not getting mixed up in that bubble. So I feel this is our hope. We'll see if it works or not. It has to be borne out by experiments. That there is going to be a set of heavy hitter bubbles in any time window of a person's life. And if that works out, then having a lot of bubbles will not hurt. The system can definitely help. But if that is not the case, then this will not work, you know, in which case we'll drop it.
So I guess I wanted to quickly address the first question. So I want to clarify what I said earlier. I didn't mean that all user studies should be small and non-rigorous. But in terms of who should ensure that things are adequately rigorous, I feel like that should be the role of the peer review process. But I personally have a thing about studies just done on students. And you see a lot of studies done on student populations. And I don't know, perhaps the peer review process could push back on that a little bit more.
Oh, to based on, do things based on, start from the users instead of starting from the geeks.
Oh yeah, so we actually, for a class I took a year ago, we actually asked people what they would like their, that same question you mentioned about the copier, how they wanted to be asked permission. We didn't phrase it in those words. And we universally got people telling us they wanted to see consent dialogues that asked them yes or no. I think that's because that's what people are used to seeing. So I think, although it is really good to ask people what they want, I think sometimes they can actually tell you something that they don't want, but they don't know they don't want it. Because people don't realize how often they would actually be faced with these, and they don't even realize that they themselves are not looking at them when they do see them.
So how would we like the peer review process to be done? No, I'm just kidding. We don't want this. It's a whole separate system.
We have another question. So bubbles specifically, and a lot of the other Android stuff I've seen, seem to focus on mobile devices as a platform for sharing data and not as much as sort of a sensor platform that does some transforms.
Great.
So it seems that, you know, my concern is like if I have an app that allows me to find out information about a can of beer I'm drinking, and it wants to scan a barcode, that's all fine. I don't really care with what data I give it, but I want to make sure that if you can access the camera, all it can do is read a barcode. Great. And that doesn't seem to fit as well into that model.
Great. It actually does. I didn't go into details here, but the concept of a bubble is this abstract boundary around data in a context, right? And the underlying system can be implemented to spread this bubble out across client devices that you own and even cloud devices. So think about cloud storage, the simplest app. Anything that you create, like take a photo, it doesn't need to always be on your phone. The bubble can extend onto some cloud storage that backs up your data. It just ensures that no one that you have not authorized to, no one gets to see that data that you have not authorized to. So the idea of a...
But I mean, the distinction I'm drawing here is that there's the data the phone collects, and then there's like a transform you could do on it. Say, if you're dealing with GPS data, maybe it makes it fuzzy. If you're dealing with a photo, maybe you're extracting a feature from it, like a QR code. How would you fit that into that kind of a UI paradigm?
Good. So about the question that you asked about the photo, like you want to take a photo, and you want to make sure that the app only has access to this one photo that I took, not all photos.
No, it's if you want to scan like a QR code on something.
Okay.
And you, so that requires the camera permission to access an app that can take photos, and then you want to make sure that this only actually scans the QR code and doesn't abuse that. How do you fit that into the UI model?
Actually, that's a good question, but I want to get a little more clarity on what do you mean by abuse that?
So you could, barcode is not quite the best idea because there are apps that scan that, but I'm thinking location data. So I might not mind if Facebook somehow privately had access to where I am and would prompt me if my friends were around, but I might very well mind if it started recording that continually.
Oh, without your explicit consent.
Something like that, yeah.
Great. So that's why when we did the, when we looked at the permissions, we found of the dangerous permissions, there are many that the system does not even need to expose to users. But location is something that a user intuitively understands, even if without having a computer. Like, even if no computers existed, location still has meaning for you. Like, do you want to share your current location with someone? Right. So this is a, and the UI of the device or of any device that you use should be built to enable that, not in a static manner, but in a dynamic manner in a, at runtime. So that when you say, okay, this guy has access to my information right now, and then once you're out of that bubble, that app doesn't see your data. So like, you launch a bubble, which is your current one, and then you run the GPS processing app or a photo processing app. You know, you scan the QR code. Once you are done, you just move out of that bubble, and the app instance that was there, that's no longer running, that has not access to your camera anymore. So see, like intuitively, when you just described your privacy requirement, it was not really tied to the app per se. You just, it doesn't matter whether it was app A or app B, whether it was a photo or a look. It mattered more to you that what I did just now should be limited to this, my phone maybe, or if you just wanted to process it for yourself, or I want to share this with my friend. I think the intuition that you want, or what you really wanted, was that what I did just now, scan this photo, take a little photo and my location, should only be shared with my friend that I just am sending to.
I'm actually, maybe it's a moot point to keep hammering on, but the thing I'm actually wondering is, what if you want to share it, some transform of that data, some function of it, so not your precise location or something.
Ah, so that you have to verify, I mean, you have to have a verified implementation of the transform.
So you end up.
Yeah.
Worrying about the app.
Yeah. So that is something logical. Like, there are approaches on quantitative information flow and things like that that approach this problem. But that piece that is doing this transformation is either trusted, or then there are problems with tracking all information flows and things like that. It's a very hairy problem.
Okay. Francie Rosner, University of Washington. I have a bit of a broader question for you all, which is, do you think that given, you know, these remaining problems with permission systems and stuff like that, like, it, you know, you become overloaded with decisions that you have to make over time, it might become unwieldy, you know, the UIs still aren't appropriate. Do you think that we already have all of the tools as system designers to create the right kinds of permission systems, or do you think we should, like, keep looking for totally different mechanisms than the ones we have? Like, are you optimistic or pessimistic about these kinds of problems going forward as people have more and more data and apps and stuff like that?
I'm actually very optimistic that as systems designers, we have quite a lot of tools. So information flow, for example, is a great little primitive. There are capabilities, there are lightweight virtual machines, and permissions that you can build on them and optimize them as she's been doing and so on. But I think the higher level question of, like, what do users want, right? And what is a nice flexible abstraction? I mean, maybe bubbles is not the right one, we'll find out. But just, there are higher level questions that I think need to be addressed first. And if they then motivate the need for a new lower level system level primitive, I mean, great, more research for us.
So I'm maybe not quite as optimistic. So one area that I think is problematic is where data goes once it leaves the phone. So we have data that shows that people feel very differently about sharing data depending on who the end party is that ends up with the data. And, you know, for example, does it go to an advertiser or does it go to the company themselves? And, you know, if you were to build something that prevents it from going to advertisers, you know, companies have a financial incentive to route it through their own servers. So I think that that is a big challenge that needs to be dealt with. I think a second smaller challenge is actually one you've worked on, which is when, you know, we talk to people about, like, I'm a huge fan of this trusted UI approach. Because it hasn't really been, not many examples have been built, platform designers are very wary because they don't really know how to do it.
I agree. I'm actually pretty optimistic about this question. Especially for the mitigation of insider threats problem, I guess we do have a very cool idea, and this system seems feasible to implement. But however, I think there's still a lot of things to do. For example, how do we measure the risk? How do we enforce the mechanism? So there are a lot of, as I said, user studies to do, especially for the company and also government and also in the school population. So I guess we have to do a lot of implement, and after that we can do the improvement, and also maybe our implementation is not the best, but I think at least for the peer production idea and for the crowdsourcing idea, which means you're relying on everybody to watch each other or monitoring each other, I think the idea is great, and but it actually needs more time to implement.
Thanks.
So this question is prompted also by things that y'all have just said. So I'm reasonably aware of what the literature says and what the history is of this business about user permissions and all that stuff. So this has been going on for a number of years, and it's pretty hard for me to figure out just exactly what the progress has been. What's not hard to figure out is that the problem is not solved. And pick some number of years, like 5 years or 6 years. You just wonder, what is it about this problem that makes it intractable over a period of, say, half a dozen years? What are the core aspects of this problem that really are impeding progress?
In general, I think the people who do the user studies don't talk a lot to the people who build the systems. I feel like there's not a lot of communication between the two groups, which is why you keep seeing history repeat itself and why the problem hasn't been solved.
One other consideration is also that this is a moving target. So 5 years back, we were using totally different systems, and the UI concerns were different from the systems now. And it's not that the same solutions will port going forward. And given that, you have to also remember that deciding how to share data or how to control your privacy is a very hard problem, even if there were no computers. So computers can actually just get you to the point where they're not in your way, but will they solve the problem? I don't think that's really what the computer techniques are there for.
Moving target is one of the oldest excuses in the book.
Okay, so we kind of concluded that even if we do our user studies and we say, hey, what do you want? We aren't going to get the right answers. And we may not even get the right answers if we would ask the user and they understood what we're asking them. So are there ways that we can build systems that can be tolerant of a single user failure or a double user failure or a multiple user failure? Is that maybe a better approach to solving this?
I guess definitely yes, because for example, in the example I gave in the presentation, we do have like a number of self-organized communities, and we're really relying on those individuals in the community to watch each other's behavior. So the role of the community, the role of the company itself is just set the risk aggregates. And we do not emphasize, for example, the role of administrators. So every malicious behaviors are normally identified through the regular scan of their behaviors and reporting from the community members. So I guess in this case, for example, in the peer production case or crowdsourcing case, we could eliminate the possible damage that could caused by a single point of failure, for example.
I do agree that community information can help people make mistakes in the first place. I don't know what to do about when the user goes ahead and makes the wrong decision, regardless of the input that's been given to them. I think in general, though, permissions are helping with that problem, which is, you know, in many cases, the mistake was that they installed an application that they shouldn't trust. And so just by virtue of having finer-grained decision-making abilities, that in and of itself can help. So even if, you know, one of those decisions is wrong, for an individual permission, hopefully the fact that the application doesn't have access to everything, only now one or two things, will help. But that is a good question.
No, I was actually thinking more about the question he asked earlier. Just because when it's a very good question, actually, because it brings about the question of how do you measure progress, and especially in a five-year span of time. So I was just looking back to works that I would think are useful progress. There was one work in Oakland on user-based access control, which I thought was pretty interesting. You know, it takes out a lot of complications regarding permissions from apps. I think her body of work is pretty good progress. I think Kevin Fu's work on getting permit, like how to securing medical devices, like not letting the users be faced with all these details, and his paper in SIGCOM is pretty good progress too. So I don't know if I completely agree with the suggestion that there has been no progress. Maybe there's a no clear, okay, here is it, here's the one representative system that solves all problems ever. Maybe we don't have that yet, but I think in terms of progress, to me it seems like we made quite a bit of progress.
Anybody have any follow-ups to?
David Brera, Carleton University. So yeah, I'll follow up what Will said. It's hard to find a one-size-fits-all solution for all platforms and then try to convince the platform developers to include our solution into their operating systems. So I think optimizing for the 80% or 90% is probably a good solution. There's always going to be people who voluntarily do stupid things. It doesn't matter how many prompts or permissions or bubbles or circles or lists or whatever you want to call them. They're always going to make these mistakes. So we should try to focus on finding what most people will find good enough, and then hope that the rest of them, you know, don't get screwed in the process. I think we have made progress. But I think there's also some legal reasons why operating system developers don't want to put stuff into their products. They like pushing the responsibility onto the users so they can't get sued. So there's all kinds of other problems why we don't actually see the results as consumers. But I think there has been progress being made. So I don't have a question, but
yeah. That's a great point.
Well, and it's not just the operators that are pushing who's making the decision. I mean, these are hard decisions to answer, right? Software developers don't know what the answer is, so they punt, right? This is historically what's happened in building software and security decisions. And we're making some steps in way to go. Sort of related to all this, we've sort of talked about permissions a lot. So that 80% might not understand what permissions are, but there still might be that 5%, those experts that understand permissions. So we're talking about sort of how do we get it, we're talking about the same thing. We keep saying it's movement targeting. We use it up as an excuse. But what it means is we need to find other ways to go around this problem. Right? Can we think out of the box in different ways? And that's why I sort of ask that idea of, well, maybe we can be tolerant to failure. Another thing is can we leverage crowdsourcing, right? For example, we have these permissions. There are experts out there. Facebook now wants to get my read phone state permission, so I have not done the update, right? If there's a mechanism for me to feed that back into the system. So maybe if you can talk a little bit how this sort of the peer production and the crowdsourcing stuff can be used to permissions.
Sorry, I want to quickly address what David said a second ago, which is that, so I live right outside a train track crossing where high-speed trains go by, and while walking my dog every morning during rush hour, I see cars scooting around and under the train guard things to like speed in front of the train, and they get hit fairly often, actually. It's horrible. But all those people know what they're doing. They know that they're going to get hit by a train if they do it anyway. So although, you know, there's like this 20% who are going to take a risk anyway, at least all those 20% know what they're doing. We're at a place right now where people are taking risks without knowing they're taking risks.
I just want to talk more about the like the crowdsourcing or peer production solutions for security. In this paper, we just gave an example of mitigating the insider threats, but of course, that peer production and crowdsourcing could be used in many other fields or implementations. For example, in a home environment or in a small office environment where you have you know, a number of people, and you trust each other, but you know, some of the people might accidentally download some malicious software, and then their best friends or other people in the community could notice that kind of misbehaving stuff, and then they can notify each other. Or if they notice that one of them has an outdated system, for example, an operating system, then they can just remind each other because, you know, the crowdsourcing design is actually relying on each one watching each other's behavior. And we actually have another paper published in NSPW, and we have like two further examples that explaining that from an economic perspective, that the security can be actually considered as a club good instead of the public good and or a private good. So from a peer production perspective, I think actually we can do, for example, community patching. So in a community, each individual could watch other people's system status, so that if you know someone's system is outdated or has not been patched, then they can actually remind each other, and also in the home environment or office environment, it will be applicable.
Just to add one slight cautionary note to the crowdsourcing of security advice. So when I was coming over in the cab, the guy asked me to write a positive review for him because apparently his competitors were funding people to write negative reviews for him. So things like this of, you know, poisoned information in a crowdsourced environment is like one example of a moving target where you use one mechanism for defense and now attackers have yet another way to poison that way that you're using to defend it. So that's actually a very interesting line of research, but it has its very interesting challenges too.
You can just look at the stock market as well, and everyone thought that Facebook was a great buy, and now everyone doesn't think it's so the crowd isn't always right, I think is a takeaway for that mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. But it can be useful in some cases.
Yes.
So do we have any more questions or comments from the audience?
Rob Templeman, Indiana University. We've talked a lot about making decisions, and we assume that the user, whether or not they're capable, should have the power to make that decision. But what about nudging or legislation? Or I guess if you just want to discuss that a little bit.
That's actually a really good question, because we've had some discussions about, so there have been a lot of vision articles about how people can maintain their privacy. And one of the requirements that people would like to have is, once I give some person some data, how do I enforce that that person doesn't do bad things with that data? Now, that's an example of a thing that needs legislation, because you know the classic DRM problems or analog hole problems, where you know once you give someone access to the data, he can always go back and publish it, and you know, just tracing it back to that person can get it's a really hairy problem that is probably best prevented using deterrence and legislation than technical means.
So, Sarjan Kapkun from Ada Hazarik. So, I've been always wondering whether things will simply get better by time, right? I mean, people have been trained over time to accept new things, right? To use whatever bathrooms and so on over centuries. So I guess over time people might get used to certain concepts, and the education will do its part, and maybe these systems that we are building will, or some of them will be a part of the educational process. So will things just get better over time? I mean, wouldn't maybe in 20 years people will get used to the concepts. They will know that the train will hit them if they go across the rails. You know, experience does this to people. So, so somehow, maybe just we just have to wait, right? I mean, the problem is simply that people are not educated enough about different types of issues, and that's why the problem is inherently difficult, right? And we can make it sort of more acceptable for more people, easier to understand, but bottom line is we'll never reach this point where everyone's going to be comfortable with the decisions that they're making, because they simply, I mean, if you ask me what kind of a medical procedure I want, if I have a certain condition, I mean, I'm probably going to give you an educated guess, right? So it's a matter of education, and I mean, this is just my thought, but I don't know much about user studies or anything of that sort, so.
So for some things, yes, but others, no. So I do think that there are some concepts that people learn over time. Like, you know, they learn maybe, you know, what Bluetooth is, or that applications use Bluetooth, or things like that. But other things are going to get worse over time if nothing changes. So as I mentioned, you know, for example, when people get their phones, these warnings are new to them. Maybe they pay attention. Actually, we've had people tell us, oh, I used to read those. But as time progresses, nothing bad happens. They click yes every time. So over time, it gets worse because there are just more and more different consent dialogues and warnings in the browser on their phone that people are just getting getting used to clicking yes to, with no adverse effects. Or at least no adverse effects that they realize stem from the fact that they clicked yes to that dialogue. And another thing, you know, we shouldn't be asking people about things that require a neurosurgeon to understand.
No, but somehow, you know, managing your data at this point or understanding all the risks might be as involved, right? So, and this is what I was referring to. I mean, there is a user fatigue, of course, with these kind of pop-up menus and so forth, and there of course that, but I don't think that. I wasn't referring to those kind of aspects. I was thinking about the fact that people will maybe naturally evolve or be educated to think in terms of the data that they manage and will be more aware of the risks. And if you look at, you know, younger generations, they certainly know what happens to a photo that they put on Facebook and how things can be shared, and they are more privacy aware, right? Even parents and grandmas these days know that, you know, they should maybe protect their password, or they shouldn't expose their PIN when they use the ATM, right? And these are the things that over time people learned. I mean, 20 years ago, people didn't do that. You know, you would find people in the street that would sort of ask you if you can withdraw some money for them because they don't know how to use this machine. It was too complex for them. So that's just a thought, right, from my side.
I was just going to add to that. If you think about clicking on links and emails, right? We've actually done a lot of progress to keeping people from opening random attachments and clicking on links. People still do it, but the percentage of people has changed a lot, and that may change as well with the models that we're looking at now.
I was just going to say that I agree in the sense that phishing attacks, for example, are a very good thing, where people can learn that your bank will never ask you for your own password and so on. So there are a lot of things that, you know. Through a random web page. So there are certain things that people can learn, but certain other things, it's our job as a systems designer to make the decisions as, you know, non-computer specific as possible. When I drive a car, I don't want to know, you know, how the carburetor works. I just want to drive.
How do we distinguish those? Can we identify those? And can we say things with these property can be learned and these things cannot? Are there ways of doing that?
That's a great question. I do not know the answer to that. One other thing related to privacy that's worth thinking about, one concern that might come up as we go forward, is not only is our privacy affected by the data that we create, but it's also affected by data that you might be creating. So if you are in a public context, you might have a camera on you at any time, and you can see on YouTube videos of random people doing things that they would rather not have been shown to the world. So that's one aspect of privacy that will get harder and harder to control as we move forward.
I just want to respond to your question, And kind of this general question here about, you know, people learning, what do they have to learn, how long does it take? So, you know, when I teach a class, and I think a lot of my colleagues where I work would feel the same way, there's a few concepts that you need to know at the end of the class. And if the students don't know those concepts, I don't think it's a matter of hanging around 20 years until they sort it out. I think it's a matter of changing the way you teach. And you know, and if what we have is a populace that's not sufficiently educated, and if our feeling is that education is what is lacking, then you can either sort of invent one technical gizmo after another to see if you can penetrate the ignorance, or you can change the way you teach, or you can make it so that whatever that concept is, it doesn't make any difference. But I think that we very often are putting the cart before the horse here. So in terms of what people need to know, it might be helpful to understand what it is that impedes them from having the understanding that you might believe they need, and then addressing whatever that particular issue is, whether it's with a technological solution or some other solution. Or I sometimes feel that in these forums, we are maybe overly focused on what technology can do, and not enough focused on just what is the core aspect of the problem. Some problems just don't fall to technology. Other problems fall fairly well. And I think it's important to make that distinction, but in particular, to focus on what the problem is, and then try to work out the appropriate solution, whatever that might be.
All right, and I think that's about time up for us. Thanks everyone for your participation. The speakers of the next session, if you can find Ian, he's standing up right there. And I believe we have a break now until 4 o'clock. Thanks.